Lord, you are exalted, Lord, always. You're always on the throne, no matter what's going on here. So we rest in that. We ask you to speak to us now this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. You can all have a seat. So we have Scott Gillis back tonight. But before we get started, I do want to encourage you. We're going to have a Q&A afterwards at the end. So I'm going to have a mic, and I will come around, and you can ask your question. If you have questions, you know, you might want to write it down or some come up during the time you're sharing, so that way you know you can remember it. That might be a good idea. That way when I get to you, you don't go, oh, I forgot. So, all right? Why don't we welcome Scott back. So.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I don't know if all of you were able to be here this morning, but if not, I would really encourage you to, I guess you guys do videos, and so it'll be on the website sometime in the future, because I hear the preacher was pretty good and pretty good looking, so it's like a double cool thing. So, but in any case, tonight we are going to talk about dinosaurs. And so how many people just love dinosaurs? Okay, and how many people, just to make sure I understand, how many people are terrified of dinosaurs? Okay, we got a few honest people over here. Yeah, that's pretty good. I do want to let you know there is good news, and we're going to cover this in a little bit more detail, but they have gone extinct. So you don't need to worry about that. So that's pretty good. Much of the information, as I mentioned this morning, you know, comes from Creation Magazine that we're going to talk about today. Different things that you can learn in and a tool that you can use. But here we are in church talking about dinosaurs. Why in the world would we do that? Because it doesn't seem to be something you normally would talk about in church. But that is a good question. But let me ask you this. How many people here have heard the idea that dinosaurs roamed the earth over 65 million years ago? Have you heard that? All right. So here's the issue, though. That whole idea of millions of years is based on the evolutionary theory, right? Okay, the idea that things evolved and through the survival of the fittest and through natural selection, even dinosaurs must have evolved. But you see, there are some huge implications if that is the case. Because if the dinosaurs are millions of years old, and if evolution in millions of years are true, I'm going to make a big, bold statement. That means the Bible is not. And I know there's probably some people who challenge me, but I would like you to be patient during this presentation and see if you can find some clues to find out if indeed that is the case. You know, for example, if millions of years and evolution are true, then we just descended from a fish. In fact, according to evolution, there would be no God, no God necessary. Adam and Eve would just be a story. Noah's Ark would be a myth. And if all those things are true, then that means God did not write the Bible. And that man is just a more highly evolved animal. And if that is the case, who determines what's right and wrong? And isn't that kind of a reflection of the culture that we're in today? So I hope you can see why not only the idea of evolution in millions of years are important, but even for believers to have answers and a defense for their faith when it comes about dinosaurs. However, the Bible does tell us a different story, as you probably know, that God created, not evolution by chance over millions of years, but that God created the heavens and the earth and everything that's in them, including dinosaurs. All right? So today, what we're going to do, or tonight, we're going to actually start. We're going to do something different when it comes to dinosaurs. We're going to start with the Bible. And we're going to think about dinosaurs from a biblical worldview. So what's a worldview, okay? A worldview is, this is really technical here, it's the way you view the world. And I like to think of it as glasses. There's different ways to view the world, including in dinosaurs. You know, for example, right now I can tell you that in the back of the room right now, there's a man. Hold on, let me see. Well, I'm pretty sure it's a man. But I can tell you, if that is a man, I can tell you with absolute objective observation that if that is a man, he has no eyes, no nose, and no mouth. Because I can see him right now. There's nothing there. It's just this big thing. Hold on. Oh, I was wrong. He does have an eye, nose, and mouth, a handsome man. Now, did anything change about him? Let's call it the facts of evidence back there. Did he change? No. what did change? The glass is specifically the evidence, the facts that came through the light reflecting off of his face into the back of my retina. But the big difference was the way that light was focused through these corrective lenses. All right. And that's kind of what a worldview is like. It's like glasses. It's the way that we take the information and focus it. All right. And if we look at dinosaurs through evolutionary glasses, of course, what we're going to see is millions of years of death. And I don't hold that against anybody because there is some logic in that. And we can talk about that later in the Q&A. Might make you think, what in the world did he just say? There's logic. But you could ask about that later. But according to evolutionary interpretations of the fossil record, there's been millions of years of death and extinction, even tumors, cancer. All right. But we are going to do something very different today. We're going to look at dinosaurs through biblical glasses. And today we're going to answer, I hope, a lot of questions. A woman came up to me and she goes, I've got questions about dinosaurs. And I said, I hope to answer them. So if she does, if I don't answer all of them, we'll be able to answer after in the Q&A. But we're going to answer a lot of questions. So I'm going to start out with a pop quiz, okay? And that is, can you name this dinosaur? All right, actually, great. Now, a more challenging question. When did Triceratops live? All right, let's make it multiple choice. Was it 65 million years ago during the Mesozoic, during the Jurassic, or we'll find out when we get to heaven? Well, actually, we don't need to go to heaven to find out. And that's what we're going to start with the Bible, and we're going to use our biblical glasses to answer that question. So let's see if the Bible gives us any clues to answer that question when Triceratops, or for that matter, the dinosaurs lived. Now, Exodus 20, this portion of Scripture is the only piece of Scripture in the entire Bible written by the hand of God, literally. You guys know that? It's called the Ten Commandments, okay? And he engraved those into stone. But it says clearly there, it says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, everything, and rested on the seventh day. So according to the Bible, God created in 6 days. All right? So now, a little bit more quiz information. Can somebody tell me, now I need to qualify, that Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That's called a merism, is what the literary term is. It means he created everything. And then he goes through and talks about what he created on each day specifically. So, let's test some of your Bible knowledge. What specifically does the Bible say he created on day one? Exactly, you are right. The light, and he separated the darkness from the light, called the darkness night and the light day. Okay, day two, what specifically did he create? All right, good. You got it. He separated the waters below to the waters above. It's sometimes called firmament, or an expanse is a better word for it. All right? Okay, day three, what did he create? First, he created two things generally. First, he did what? Now keep in mind, in the beginning it says that the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So originally this planet was a worldwide ocean. But on day three, what appeared? Land. And on the land he created plants, vegetation. Exactly. All right. Day four, what did he specifically create? Right, the celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and the stars, exactly. On day five, specifically, what did he create? See, this guy knows it all. You're going to let him do this? Come on, let's have it. That is correct, swimming and flying things, all right? On day six, first he created land animals, and then Adam and Eve. All right, now, that answers this question. So what's the answer? On the sixth day, because dinosaurs are land animals, all right? By definition, they are, all right? But now we got a problem. Based on evolutionary glasses, we have a problem. And because man and dinosaurs were created on the same day. If you need evidence, we're going to talk about a little bit of it, but I do like the Kodak Study Bible as a source. But this isn't very scientific, all right? But as we talked about this morning, Jesus said, if I've told you earthly things and you do not believe, things about dinosaurs, then how will you believe when I speak of heavenly things? So I hope you can see how this is important. Okay, another pop quiz. What dinosaur is this? T-Rex. All right. Now, a more challenging question. And what did the first T-Rex eat? Okay. Now, we will make it multiple choice. Meat, plants. Meat and plants. Or Happy Meals. All right, so the question is, many of you, you know, you were here this morning, so you learned plants. Now, you might be thinking, you've got to be kidding. T-Rex ate plants. I mean, just, we know, we've seen the movies. They're out to kill us. They're struggling for survival. And, of course, you've seen the movies. And I want to let you know, I have personal experience in this, so I understand where you're coming from on that. However, like I said, we need to find out, did he have a brachiosaurus burger or a mammoth steak or what was on the menu? Again, we're going to use the Bible in order to answer this. And as we talked about this morning, in the last verses of Genesis chapter 1, it does say that all plants that God gave man and animals, plants for food, because remember, there's no death, there's no suffering before the fall. So that means that if Genesis is true, then that means that we and the dinosaurs and the lions and tigers and bears, that means that we and the dinosaurs and the lions and tigers and bears, thank you, all right, did not kill and did not eat meat. And you're thinking, have you seen a T-Rex? I mean, look at those sharp teeth. This is a killing machine, right? You know, kind of like this guy right here. Okay? In fact, does anybody, I mean, you take a look at that. The front teeth look like they were designed to hold the prey. The back teeth, I actually know, are sharp enough to cut a piece of paper. Does anybody know what species this might be? You're actually very close. Very close. This is a fruit bat. Now, does anybody want to take just a wild guess about what the main diet of a fruit bat might be? Anybody want to guess what it is? All right. So, in this case, all right, those sharp teeth does not mean that it eats meat. It only means what? It just has sharp teeth. That's all. And it must use that in order to eat fruit. Do you agree with me? All right. How about this guy? What species is this? Saber-toothed tiger? What? Walrus? Okay, or it might be a deer. This is a animal that lives today in Asia, all right? And it only eats leaves, berries, and saplings. But if you saw that and dug that up as a fossil, wouldn't you say it's a ferocious killing machine? But you know what? In this case, sharp teeth does not mean that it eats meat. It only means what? That it has sharp teeth. How about this guy? I'm going to give you a clue on this one. This is a bear. It's a ferocious, terrifying, that basically only eats bamboo. It's its main source of food, but eats no meat. So again, I've given you another example of animals that have sharp teeth that don't eat meat. Right? And guess what? I could show you many more. This is only an example. So, and in fact, has anybody here ever carved a pumpkin? Anybody? Yeah, young lady, can I ask you, what did you use to carve your pumpkin? A knife. Specifically, what kind of knife? Sharp knife. Thank you. Yeah. There was no leading going on there, all right? But it came in handy. All right, so now I'm going to show you a picture. You might laugh, but it stands up to the evidence we just discussed. Does that make sense to anybody? Did I or did I not just give you a bunch of examples of some ferocious-looking creatures that did not eat meat? All right. Now, please, do not go home or go to school and say, hey, the creation guy said that T-Rex, you know, was vegetarian. Okay, after the fall, he was a ferocious killing machine. By the way, most dinosaurs were herbivores and not carnivores. Most of them were. Another thing that's great, like I mentioned, Creation Magazine, you get to learn things about tyke. Now, tyke is a lion that lived on a farm. The owners decided to make him a pet. I wouldn't recommend that in general. But what's happening is this lion would not eat meat. They hired experts because they knew that it was a fact that this lion could not survive without meat. And they gave a cash reward to anybody that could get tyke to eat meat. And they made these formulas. And even if they put a little bit of blood inside the milk, even one drop, tyke would refuse to eat that. Well, tyke was fully grown and thrived his entire life without meat. In fact, lived a longer life than most lions do. And he ate mostly tall grass and grazed. I'm not saying all lions do that, but I'm just saying that. He lived with lambs and cattle and peacocks and never had one of them for dinner. Another lion we actually report in the magazine, its favorite meal, this is not tyke, another animal, his favorite meal was spaghetti. And he was picky because if the sauce didn't have the right spices in it, he would snub his nose. So he only ate spaghetti. All right, so I've given you some examples that necessarily these killing machines aren't necessarily the way that it always was, according to the Bible. All right, originally the animals did not eat meat. Next question. A lot of people ask me, in fact, this morning, somebody asked me this question. Were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? And again, we're going to see if the Bible gives us any clues about that. So, does the Bible say that God brought two of every kind to the ark except for dinosaurs or except for anything else? Does it say that? No. So that would mean dinosaurs were on the ark. Crazy concept. The guy I'm speaking to today goes, I never thought about that, but that is the case. Next question, how did they fit? Oh my goodness, they're so huge, it seems Noah has some problems, you know? How do you get those guys in there? But again, using our biblical glasses, we need to think biblically about this question. So the next question is, oh yeah? Well, how big was the ark? Well, when we use the Bible, it does give us some exacting clues. In fact, it answers this question directly. It talks about how big that it was, all right? In fact, if you take it, that it was at least 450 feet long at a minimum, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. We're talking about a huge vessel. And if you can see here, there's two people to give you an idea of the size of this monstrous vessel. In fact, it was so big that it could hold 522 stock cars, railroad stock cars. That would be a train 8 miles long. Be thankful the next time you pull up to a train that that's not going to happen. But a train with that many cars, which would be able to fit into this ark, would hold as many as 125,000 animals the size of a sheep. And today, only 11% of animals are larger than a sheep. So we got a lot of room, especially considering that there have been calculations by the people that do a study called baryminology that basically estimate, with some good scientific backup, that it would take about 16,000 animals on the ark. And that would only take up 11% of the volume in order to get all the genetic diversity we have in the world today. Lots of room on the ark, actually. It looked a little like this. You can see a sauropod climbing up the ramp there. All right, it was a big, big thing, and it looked nothing like this, okay? We've got to get that out of our kids' minds. And I don't mean to offend anybody, but if you're telling your children stories about Noah's Ark, we need to tell them the truth, don't you think? Don't want to get this idea in the mind. However, you might be thinking, yeah, but come on, Scott. Dinosaurs were huge. And I will agree, some of them were really, really big. But did you know that actually the average size dinosaur was the size of a bison? Not really all that big. In fact, plenty of the dinosaurs were really small. Okay? Now, I do want to share with you, this is my son's toy T-Rex. Okay, when he was a little kid, he used to go around, and it has an articulating jaw, so it's a really fun toy to play around with. And he would go around saying, hey, look at my T-Rex, it's full size. This is a real full-size T-Rex. It's the full size. So let me ask you a question. Is it full size? Exactly. It is full size when that dinosaur came out of its egg. In fact, the largest dinosaur egg that has ever been discovered is slightly bigger than a football. All right? And all, even the biggest of dinosaurs, started out small. So, here's the question. Would God want to put some stinky old grandpa dinosaurs on the, and I wasn't looking at any grandpa, stinky or otherwise, when I said that. I'm just talking about, would he have some old dinosaurs or some young, strong, maybe pre-adolescent, teenage-like dinosaurs, all right? I think they would have a lot more breeding years left. It would be the way to go. So they don't have to be huge. Now, we've already talked about how big the ark was and maybe how big the dinosaur was, which isn't necessarily all that big. But the next question would be, you would say, but there's so many dinosaurs. I mean, for heaven's sakes, even if there weren't. I mean, in fact, today there are 700 species of dinosaurs that have been identified by scientists. But did you know that some prevalent scientists, including the great Jack Horner, who is probably the number one paleontologist in the world today at Montana State University, believes that those species, many of those species, aren't real? And let me explain what I mean by this. Here are three species of dinosaur, but Jack Horner has discovered that these are the same animal at different levels of growth, at different maturity levels. Okay? In fact, he even said that probably one-third of all the named dinosaur species never even existed. So we're not talking about that many species. But, again, we're using the Bible as our starting point. And does the Bible say God brought two of every species to the ark? No. It says two of every kind. All right. Now, we don't have a scientific term that defines kind. But, like I said, the people at Dayton University and the head of the baromenology study group are trying to figure out what is a kind. And I'm going to give you some clues about what is a kind with something maybe you're more familiar with, and that is dogs. Now, on the left is Gibson, who in 2004 was the world's largest dog. And I don't know if you can see down there to his right, that is Boo Boo, who in 2007 was the world's smallest dog, all right? Almost looks like Gibson's thinking about having a snack, doesn't it? He's just thinking, I wonder. But you see, according to the Bible and according to the study of baromenology, guess what? There would only be one dog kind that Gibson and Boo Boo descended from. And you might be thinking that's a little crazy, but see, secular scientists, when they've mapped the genome for dogs, have found out that they claim that all dogs that are alive today from Gibson to Boo Boo all descended from a wolf-like creature and put it on the cover of the magazine. Okay? So, can we apply this dog thing to dinosaurs? Again, what species is this? Triceratops, right? But just like dogs, Triceratops believed to what we call the Ceratopsian kind. This is not something that creationists have come up with. This is secular scientists talking about this category of Ceratopsian dinosaurs. These are all different species, but do you see the similarities they have? They all have the frill in the back, the horns at the edges of those frill. Many varieties, but there was probably only one pair of a Ceratopsian kind, and these are the different species that descended from it. And if you look around the room, if you want to get another example of another kind, all right, that's changed. Just look around the room. It's called a humankind, and we have all kinds of different shapes, sizes, and colors and varieties right here, right? Same thing was happening. So like dogs and people and the dinosaurs, there are the different kinds on the ark. And we have determined, based on genetics and baromenology, there was probably about 50 different kinds of dinosaurs, so there would be about 100 dinosaurs on the ark. Plenty of room for the other animals. Now, the next question you might be thinking is, well, if there were 100 dinosaurs on the ark, and if they came off of the ark, what happened to all the others? What happened to all the other dinosaurs that weren't on the ark? Yeah. They died. And they got buried, many of them, not very many, but some of them got buried, and a few of them became fossils. And we talked about fossils this morning, okay? And they've remained buried since the flood in great number, but some of them have been discovered. Scientists, paleontologists have dug them up. And I don't know if you knew this, but the first dinosaur bones were discovered in the 1800s. Did you guys know that? I want you to keep that in mind, because that's an important fact that's going to become important as we go along. So when were the first dinosaur bones discovered? 1800s. Great. All right. So how did they become fossils? As you remember, we talked about today, this whole idea that it was slow and gradual over millions and millions of years as it slowly gets buried and turned into a fossil. But does the evidence support that? We talked about that a little bit this morning, but here's an interesting thing. At Dinosaur National Monument, along with the dinosaurs, guess what else we have? Clams. Now, does anybody think dinosaurs and clams live together? I mean, one's in the ocean, one's a land creature, but here they are all jumbled together. Okay, how did they get there all in the same place? Did they die there? Because dinosaurs and clams wouldn't die in the same place, right? See, this is evidence of a catastrophic flood that jumbled them all up and put them, in this case, there was a dam in the flow that pulled all these creatures together that were taken from the ocean and all over the place. There's logs mixed in that are petrified, all kinds of things. So, did this happen over millions of years of slow and gradual burial? No, the evidence would show quite the difference that it was a catastrophic event that buried all these creatures at the same time. Let's take a look at another fossil, more evidence. Now, on the left there is Protoceratops, and he's in battle with the one on the right, a very famous, now famous dinosaur called Velociraptor. You guys probably know why he got famous. A little movie. I don't know if you've seen it. But using biblical glasses, it appears that these two creatures might have been in battle. So does this look like slow and gradual processes to you over millions of years, or were these guys buried quickly? Now, there's only about 1,200 complete dinosaur skeletons in the museums around the world today. You get lots of dinosaur bones, but only about 1,200 complete skeletons. However, there are millions of these all around the world, dinosaur tracks. You know, we see animal tracks today. In fact, has anybody ever had a deer track in their backyard? Right? And tell me, how long do those deer tracks last? Millions of years, right? No, because some kind of storm or something's going to come. So how do we make a fossil out of tracks like this? Well, the only way, somebody tell me. Somebody tell me, how do we preserve tracks like this? It's got to be buried. Now, in the case of the deer, you might take some plaster of Paris and go out there and make a mold and you can save it. But unless it gets buried quickly, it's not going to happen. So another stratum, another layer, covered these up to preserve them. But it's interesting because when we look at these, we believe that this is a theropod dinosaur because of the way the footprints are. But on the right, notice it's just two toes, if you will, all right, that are dragging. The right foot gets planted, and the left foot gets planted, and the right foot's dragging. In fact, there's a force pushing against this dinosaur as it made each one of these tips. In fact, its right foot is just on its tippy toes, and it's barely getting by, all right? And this isn't just isolated. This happens all the time. Now, there's two forces. One of them is called gravity because it's going uphill. And the other one is giving us evidence right here. And those little things there are ripple marks of water that is rapidly moving, causing these ripples, hitting this dinosaur in a lateral way, fighting to go against a current as it goes uphill. Again, got your biblical glasses on? Does that remind you of anything from in the Bible? This dinosaur was, and many of them were along with him, trying to escape from the flood. All right, let's get the next question here. Is the word dinosaur in the Bible? And the answer is no, it is not. Now, you remember when we talked about the first dinosaur bones being discovered in the 1800s, and this guy named Richard Owen invented the word dinosaur, which means terrible lizard. All right? But he invented the word in 1841. The reason is because they started discovering these huge reptilian-like creatures, and he came up with this name. And you see, that word dinosaur didn't even exist in when the first English translations were made. So why in the world would the word dinosaur be in the Bible? It wouldn't make any sense. All right? So there's no word dinosaur, but there is another word in the Bible. Okay? It comes from a Hebrew term. All right? And it represents, they used an English word to translate into English this particular Hebrew term tanin. And it reminds of giant reptiles with claw, teeth, and horns. Does anybody know what that English word might be? Well, Leviathan's in there a few times. This word actually occurs 34 times in the Old Testament. Dragon. That's only in the King James Version. All right. That's the only time they did it that way. But back then, dragon, the word dragon meant a monstrous creature. It didn't mean this wing thing that, you know, did the things in the Disney movies. So the question is, were they the dinosaurs of history? Now, do we have any fishermen here tonight? Oh, okay, you're not the right kind that I need. Do we have any other fishermen? And I'll explain that later. Any fishermen? Come on. Really? Okay. It doesn't work. I needed a married couple where the man is a fisherman in order to make my illustration. This is a real shame here. No fishermen? All right, but anyhow, here's the thing. I happen to know that when men go fishing, they say, I caught one this big. But then when their wife opens the cooler, it's not that big, right? That's what all red-blooded men do. We exaggerate everything we do. We make it always seem better than it is, all right? It's in our blood. And it's called a fish story. Have you guys heard that term? Okay. We always exaggerate what's happening. So my question is, could it be that the dinosaurs of history are the dragons of legend? But I'd like to correct that. I'd like to say the dragons of history. They're not legends. And let me explain that. There are dragons in history books. All over the world, every continent except Antarctica has historical accounts of what they call dragons. Many different people in many different places over many different times, over thousands and thousands of years. But yet, these accounts, historical accounts, describe these dragons. And it's very similar to exactly what we know to be dinosaurs today. But there's also not just words, but there's also things that we can look at. Okay, now this is a real dinosaur skull. All right. Now National Geographic hired an artist to draw a picture of what this guy, Dracorex, looked like. And they put him on the cover of their magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you a real dinosaur. That's not a dragon. That is a dinosaur. That's the real thing. But if I had hired Disney to draw anything else, would it be any different than that? And you've got to understand that the idea of dragons are on all kinds of continents, all kinds of people. St. George and the Dragon, if you've ever been to France, this is one account that was actually seen by many hundreds of people where St. George slew the mighty dragon that was about to devour the king's daughter. Nice exaggeration. But guess what? The artwork all shows what we now know to be an iguanodon dinosaur. It looks just like that. Even here in this continent, the Native Americans saw the mighty Thunderbird. It was a huge flying reptile. And I think it's no coincidence that the mighty Quetzalcoatl, a pterosaur, where we found fossils in Utah, Texas, and Arizona, are found. And indeed, we find artists that drew them on their cave walls. Evidence that these men saw these huge pterosaurs. All right? And here we have what appears to be a sauropod in Natural Bridges National Monument. Let's go back to Europe. In the 1400s, Carlisle Cathedral has the tomb of a guy named Bishop Richard Bell, buried in 1496, right there on the altar, right underneath a piece of carpet, and carved in the brass around his tomb, all right, are a fish, a dog, a pig, and a bird. And I have a book back there where you can see actual pictures of this, and this guy right here, which appears to be a sauropod dinosaur. How about this? Artwork from over 4,000 years ago. On the top is a stone carving of what they would call a dragon, but it matches the one below, which is a real Protoceratops dinosaur. That book, Dire Dragons, that we have in the back, has almost 100 examples of artwork that predates the discovery of dinosaur bones that matches. Now, I want to share my favorite one. This one's in Cambodia. at the Angkor Wat Temple, which was dedicated in 1186. That's almost 700 years before the first dinosaur bones were discovered. But I want to zoom in on that middle figure. Can you guys identify that? Stegosaur, you can tell because of the alternating plates on the back and the horns on the front. Even a child knows that's a stegosaur. But how did they know what a stegosaur looked like in 1186 AD if one hadn't been dug up before that time? Do you guys see the evidence? You guys see it? So like I said, there is a book back there called Dire Dragons. It's a great coffee table book. You put that on your coffee table when your crazy Uncle Joe comes over that thinks you're a little idiot for believing the Bible. Have him open that and watch the sparks fly this Thanksgiving. I'm telling you, that'll do it. Now, does the Bible say anything about dinosaurs after the flood? You know? And I think it does. There's one guy that seems to have seen dinosaurs. His name was Job. All right? He lived after the flood. And Job, you might remember the story. Basically, Job is saying to God, why did you let this happen? Right? Why did you let this happen? His friends come in and try to give him explanations. But finally, God speaks up, right? That's the best part. And did you notice God doesn't answer him directly? It's interesting because God speaks to Job over four chapters and he reviews his creation. He said, Job, consider this. I'm the creator. I have all wisdom and power. And take a look at my creation. And he goes through a bunch of animals. I like to call it Job's Park. And God walks him through creation. He said, well, I'm going to question you. And he said, have you ever considered the lion, the ravens, on and on. And talking about not only the animals, but God's creation in general. Until he gets to chapter 40. And he mentions, hey, let me tell you about one really good one. In fact, he spends more time on this creature than any of the others. He's called Behemoth. All right? And God created Behemoth. All right? Just as God created Job. And he's trying to explain that to him. And there's a lot of speculation about what Behemoth might be. And it's interesting because in the footnote of the biggest English translation of the Bible, there's actually here a footnote that says it could be a hippo or an elephant. So that's an interesting idea, but let's compare that to sauropod dinosaurs. I'd like to propose a sauropod. Now it says that Behemoth eats grass. Now do hippos eat grass? How about elephants? Mm-hmm. And then what about a sauropod? Yeah, actually, they did. Yep, and we know that because of what's called coprolite. Does anybody know what coprolite is? I've got a piece of it right up here. This is fossilized coprolite, okay? This is a slice of coprolite. Does anybody know what coprolite is? Yeah. And guess what? Scientists can actually see what they ate. Now, if any of the young people want to come up and touch the coprolite and you could smell it. I wouldn't lick it because too many kids have tried that. But anyhow, the thing is the evidence would show that there were grasses in the fossil dino doo-doo. By the way, evolutionists believe that grasses evolved after dinosaurs, but yet how could they eat them? Next question. His bones are like tubes of bronze. He's got big bones. Does an elephant have big bones? How about a hippo? How about a sauropod? Yeah. Okay, so far they both check out. And its tail moves like a cedar. And you've got to keep in mind that the cedar trees that used to build the temple were huge. They were really big. But it says his tail was like a cedar tree. But does this look like a cedar tree to you? So I think it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. But this one does fit. And I think that when God was talking about Behemoth, that it could have been one of those great sauropods. And by the way, at the end of chapter 40, it says that Behemoth could stand in the River Jordan, or it implies that he could stand in the River Jordan at flood stage and keep his head above water. All right? Well, today, the River Jordan at flood stage in this particular location that we're referring to was 45 feet deep at flood stage. Do you think a dinosaur could stand there and go against the current and keep its head above water? I mean, a hippo or an elephant, they couldn't do that, but a sauropod could. Okay, so next question. Let's keep going through these questions. If they came off the ark, where are they now? Last year, did you see any dinosaurs at the zoo? No. Well, evolutionists have theories about why they're not here anymore. Of course, the great asteroid impact theory, a big kaboom, a massive catastrophic climate change. But not all evolutionists agree on that, because there are problems, because turtles, crocodiles, snakes, and mammals all lived through this. And they're buried with the dinosaurs. So this catastrophe didn't kill just the dinosaurs. But the bottom line is that evolutionists don't know why they went extinct. But tonight, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened to the dinosaurs. The problem is no one knows for sure, but the Bible does give us some clues. That God created the dinosaurs, and that a flood came and 100 of them were on the ark. The Ice Age could have very much played a role in the extinction or the depletion of dinosaurs, because a large reptile, most scientists accept them to be cold-blooded. There is some dissension about that. But an Ice Age would be hard on a large cold-blooded reptile. Do you think disease after a flood could have had something to do with it? Or maybe a food source that was scarce? And have other animals gone to the point of extinction even today besides dinosaurs? All right, so there are many, many causes. But I would like to consider another idea. And this is a crazy idea, but my idea is, did man have a role? You might be thinking, oh, he's gone crazy. But let's take a look at some of the evidence. Keep in mind that in the beginning that we were not to eat meat, but later on God did give us permission to eat meat. And do you or do you not think that that would have been a delicious and steak? In fact, you know what? Other animals were hunted to the point of extinction. Am I right? Right? And since we don't have any fishermen, I imagine we don't have any hunters here today too, you know. But anyhow, can you imagine if you were a hunter, how cool would it be to put that trophy up over the fireplace? Wouldn't that be, oh my goodness, yeah. But if you came home tonight and there was a dinosaur in your backyard, you'd probably do something about it. Every red-blooded man would. But it's interesting because in third world countries, you can find YouTube videos, even contemporary videos, of men killing elephants, a single man killing an elephant with only one spear. And any skilled hunter knows where the kill zones are and are skilled hunters. And believe me, they had to be skilled hunters back in that time. So it's very, very possible that man could have killed these even without firearms. So you know what? If the post-flood man were to come home and the dinosaurs were sitting there knocking down the huts and threatening the village and everything, he would get out his spear and he would hunt that, because first off, his wife's not going to let him back in for dinner. You go kill that thing, all right? And he gets to feed the entire village with one animal. How cool is that? And he gets to throw that trophy up over the fireplace. But more important than that, he goes down in written history as the man that slew the mighty dragon. Remember me telling you about those thousands of historical accounts in writing in history books? Almost uniformly, all of them have man hunting and killing the mighty dragon. So do you think man could have had an impact on their extinction? I say that. Slay the mighty dragon. Go down in history. So if somebody ever asks you if you believe in the age of dinosaurs, all right, tell them no. Tell them that you believe in the five ages of dinosaurs, that God created them and that they lived with people. And the next one was that sin came into the world, all right, that death came and that they started to kill. But then sometime thereafter, when sin became so great that God did decide to punish, that all of the animals that were not on the ark were killed. And then after that, they diminished. They became so rare that they wrote them down in history and called them dragons, till eventually we find their bones from the flood and rediscover things. So the summary of the Bible's account, I'm hoping that it convinces you that you don't need to be afraid of dinosaurs in millions of years, that there is a defense that you can happen. There's nothing to fear. And in fact, I think it helps us to explain the gospel. You know, the fossils that we find of these creatures, you know, indicate death. And when we talk about the fossils of these great creatures, we can talk about death and really go back to Genesis and start talking about how death came into the world and have a defense for our faith and use dinosaurs to do that. You know, and if we're sharing our gospel and say that Jesus loves you, and if they don't think the Bible is true, which is the only source we know about Jesus' love, and if they have questions about dinosaurs or anything else, and if we don't have the answers, there's an eternal consequence, isn't there? And by the way, if our children come home and ask mom and dad or grandma and grandpa and they don't have answers, there can be a consequence for that too. So that's why we need to be prepared. That's why you find the answers at creation.com. Anything about dinosaurs or any kind of subject at all when it comes to the evolution creation debate, you can find the answers. I mentioned, here's this book about evidence of humans and dinosaurs living together. And if you're looking for answers to your questions, you can do that. But in summary, evolution usually gets the credit for forming the dinosaurs over millions of years, right? But folks, we got to reclaim that. Dinosaurs are God's creation, all right? And we need to give the Creator glory for what He has made, and that even includes those great dinosaurs. All right, so I mentioned we have the Answers book. So what we're going to do, time permitting, somebody's going to have to cut us off. We're going to go ahead and do a question and answer time, all right? There are some rules, though. I have rules. Please be patient with me, because I don't know the answer to all the questions, but I'm going to try to do as best as I can. But here are the rules. Ready? Rule number one, your question needs to be in the form of a question. Unfortunately, some of you aren't going to get that, and I don't want to be rude to interrupt you and say, what's your question, okay? Your question needs to be in the form of a question, okay? Please do it that way. Secondly, it needs to be about evolution and creation. It doesn't have to be about dinosaurs. It can be anything in that realm, but we're not going to talk about eschatology, soteriology, and all those other ologies. You can ask Pastor Will about those kind of things. So we'll just stick to that. So I know that some people are shy to ask questions, you know, so you don't want to put your hand up. So we're going to skip whoever has the first question and go right to the second one. Who has that? Go ahead and put your hand up. Okay, right here. We'll get back to you.
We're actually going to, I'm going to wait for me to bring the mic over to you so that way we can catch it on there for those who are streaming and also for the recording and so we can all hear you.
How do you answer the question about light years?
Oh, great. First question. Awesome. Just awesome. And the reason I say that is because you're starting out with probably the most difficult question. So I'll do my best in a short amount of time. Okay, so in essence, like I said, be patient with me. Okay, so the question that he's basically asking is that if God created heavens and the earth and everything that is in 6 days, and then on day four, he created all of the stars and the planets and the sun, that right now we know with rather great certainty that some of those stars are incredibly long distances away, all right? And the question is, how did light get here? Well, we have different ways of measuring the distance, okay, how big the universe is. You know, one way we can do it is the same way that we do it. In fact, if you take your finger and you close it and you go back and forth, you notice how your finger seems to shift, but it's not moving, right? And that's called parallax, and we can actually do some trigonometry and figure it out. So what we do is we sight a star when the Earth is at one end of its elliptical orbit, and then we can measure that same angle when it's at the other end, and we can do some mathematics. Now, most stars are too far away to use this measurement. But there's also, you probably heard of the Doppler effect, perhaps. Okay, that's like when a train goes by, and it goes, okay, and the tone goes down. That's because the sound waves, as it's coming towards us, they're stacking on each other. But as it goes away, the sound waves split up, so it actually lowers its tone. Well, the same thing happens when we look at the universe, okay? Now, let me ask you this. A light year, is that a measure of time or distance? It's actually a measure of distance. It's the amount of distance that light travels in 1 year. Some stars are millions of light years away. So how did the light get here so fast? Well, Big Bangers, by the way, people that believe in Bang, they have the exact same difficulty in there. I'm even going to say something that's a little crazy. And the reason I can say this is because Dr. John Hartnett, who's one of our cosmologists, has said it, and he's highly qualified. In fact, he's developed the most accurate clocks in the world, or excuse me, in the universe today. All right. Very, very brilliant man. He actually has more papers published in secular scientific journals than Richard Dawkins and P.Z. Myers combined. He is a very wise man. And these are the words that he told us. He said, cosmology is not science. That's going to really upset a lot of cosmologists. But he is a cosmologist, and he would know. And the reason that we say that is because, unlike biology, where we can hold things in our hand and observe them in the present, or geology, where we can take a rock and observe it and test it, we can touch it, we can smell it, we can feel it, right? Cosmology is completely different because we can't touch it. We can't bring it into the laboratory. There's only one thing we have, and that's light coming from these stars, and we interpret what we think is happening. And I want to let you know that secular cosmologists, and this is a bold statement, secular cosmologists really don't have any idea what's going on or whatever did happen. The theories continue to change, and most of them, if they're honest, will do that. All we have are theories, and very loosely believed theories, okay? So anyhow, they have the exact same problem as we do. In fact, it's called the horizon problem. And in fact, if the Big Bang happened, all right, then it turns out that what's called the cosmic background radiation, if we measure the temperature, yeah, why did you start out with this question? Because I'm going to have people fall asleep on me here in a second. But here's the thing. When we look out in space, I'll try to keep it really simple. It seems that it's the same temperature everywhere. And if indeed we can see 15 billion light years this way and 15 billion light years that way, that means the universe that we know of right now might be bigger. Is it about 30 billion light years at least across? But all of that light and that energy has evened out, and they don't have enough time. They have the exact same problem. So let me see if I can, there you go. Let me forward through here. I'm trying to get past all the boring parts here. Oh, okay. One of the biggest ideas is that gravity distorts time. Did you know that clocks tick faster at higher elevation where there's less gravity, a little less gravity, than they do at sea level? So clocks tick faster in Denver than they do down at the beach. All right? That's something that we can measure. Einstein actually predicted that to be the case. In fact, GPS satellites actually have to have an adjustment, all right, because their clocks on those satellites go faster than the ones down. It's a very small amount, but that's the case. So we now know that gravity distorts time. Oh, my goodness, there's a lot of boring stuff in here that I'm going to skip by. Come on. I'm trying to get to the exciting part. All right, well, basically, here's the idea, is that the clocks at low gravity, which on day four would have been at the extremities. You see, there's a phrase in the Old Testament that occurs 17 times. It says that God stretched out the heavens like a tent, right? And 17 different times he uses the term stretched out the heavens, all right? So the idea is that on day four, he stretched out the heavens, all right? And since we are probably near the center, and there is evidence for that, we had the gravity that we have right here, but there was virtually no gravity out there. Time is distorted, and the clocks out there in the stars went perhaps 1 million times faster than they did here on Earth. So when one day passed here, millions of years passed or more passed outside of that. So right now, if anybody wants to sing the Twilight Zone theme song, you would be appropriate right here. But my main thing is, remember that cosmology doesn't do that. If you want an easy to understand explanation of that answer, you can get the answers book and read chapter 5. It'll go into other details. You can also go onto our website, which is, and you can find out more information. There's a book out there, if you're a real brainiac, by John Hartnett about starlight and time. Go ahead and pick that up if you want to torture your brain. If you want to make something simple, there's a DVD out there called Light Years Not a Problem. I think that's the name of it. It's a 20-minute video. That's why we kept the price down. By Dr. Russell Humphreys, who is considered one of the great creation cosmologists, where we filmed him. And for the first time, we made it easy to understand. And you can get that, and in 20 minutes, you'll understand what I just did with great graphics and really understand. So can somebody please give it another question that maybe isn't so complicated?
Hope this is a little easier. How accurate is carbon dating?
How accurate is carbon dating? And that's not too bad. I still feel like I'm going to lose people here. You know what? I'm going to do it without the pictures because it takes me a while to do this. I'll wave my hands. Is that okay? Okay, I'm going to use an analogy if you don't mind. And I'll use you. Okay, you come home tonight. All right? You get home. Nobody's home. All right? And you hear the water running, a lot of water running. In fact, you know that a pipe has burst in your house. You go into a panic. Oh, my goodness, what's going on? Nobody's home. And whoosh, you hear the water running. You run into the house. You run upstairs to the bathroom where the sound's coming from. And you see the tub is going full force. Right? You're like, what is going on? And you take the 1 gallon pail that you have next, the 1 gallon bucket that you have next to the bathtub. I want everybody to listen because I'm going to ask you some math. So listen in, okay? You take the 1 gallon pail, you hold it underneath the faucet, you take your watch and you count 60 seconds pass in order for that 1 gallon pail to fill up. You guys listening? Okay. All right. Now you later measure that there are 15 gallons in the bathtub. How long did it take to put 15 gallons in the bathtub? Okay. Now here's the problem, folks. You guys all came up with a logical conclusion. You said it took 15 minutes, right? Because 1 minute per gallon is 15 gallons. Really simple, right? Okay, that's the same assumptions used by radioisotope dating scientists. All right? But unfortunately, were you there when it came on? No. Okay, was there some water in the tub before it started? You don't know. Well, did somebody take that pail and take some out? Did somebody add some in? Was somebody playing with the plug? Was somebody taking the faucet, turning it up and down, off and on? Now, do you see all the assumptions that were made in that little thing? Those are the same type of assumptions that secular scientists use, that the decay rate of radioisotopes has never changed. All right? And as I gave you one example, and we could give you hundreds more, all right, there are, when they do tests of rocks, when they are known age, virtually it never is true. When we know a rock is 10 years old, send it to a radioisotope dating lab, they tell it's millions of years. Okay? So that means that the assumptions that they use are incorrect. The RATE group, all right, did a very large, boring study that basically showed that there are many pieces of evidence to show that sometime in the past that the radioactive decay rate increased greatly at some time in the past. Very specific evidence, so you can do that. Now I'm going to take and try not to bore you too much. The question was, what about carbon dating? All right. So carbon 14 is radioactive and it has what's called a half-life. Does anybody remember what a half-life is? Okay. It's half of the amount. So let's say I have this much carbon 14 in a sample of a living creature. All right. After one half-life, half of it will decay. After another half-life, a fourth of it will be left. After another half-life, an eighth. Well, the half-life of radiocarbon is 5,730 years. Okay? If we have any math whizzes, think about that. I'm going to round it to 5,000 years. That means after 5,000 years, half of it's left. 10,000 years, a quarter. Okay? 15,000, an eighth. And eventually, it's going to get so small, you can't even measure it. There's so little left. And that happens, depending upon which scientist you talk to, between 50 and 90,000 years. Carbon dating can never give you millions or billions of years. You have to use other radioisotopes that have a longer half-life. So if anybody comes to you and says, well, carbon dating proves millions of years, that means they really, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. That doesn't mean you disparage them and say, oh, you're stupid. You just use that as a way of explaining really what's happening. Okay, we started out with two very technical questions, but that's okay. I'm all for it. Let's see if we get another one, yes.
How many hours in a day were the first 6 days?
Sure. You tell me.
I don't know the answer to that.
You don't know the answer? It's in the Bible.
But I don't remember it being in Genesis.
Yeah, evening and morning the first day, evening and morning the second day, yeah. Evening and morning. Yeah, 24 hours, just like today. Is there any reason not to think that? Okay, let me ask you this. Of course. I know, but here's the thing. If they go for 25 hours, which is kind of absurd, okay, does that help them any? No. So the only thing they can do is to say it was millions or billions of years, right?
That's what they say to me.
Okay. So let me, this is what I would ask them. Okay, assuming, because if they're asking how many hours are in a day, that gives the assumption that they're perhaps believe, that they believe the Bible. All right? So here's the question I ask them. I say, well, that's really interesting. I've heard that idea before, but tell me, how many millions of years was Jonah in the big fish? No. How many millions of years was Jonah in the big fish? Do you understand where I'm going? Everybody knows it was 3 days. Do you know why they know it's 3 days? Because the Bible says he was in there 3 days. Let me ask you another question. How many millions of years did the Israelites march around Jericho? They did it on how many days? 7 days, right? Everybody knows that, right? In Numbers 17, there's a really cool account. I think it's number 17. That the tribes of Israel come and they present their gifts to build the tabernacle. It says on day one, the tribe of blah, brought purple dyed beaver pelts or whatever it was. And then on day two, this tribe brought whatever their gift, gold, and this one brought this silver and this much, right? So, and there's 12 tribes. How many millions of years did they do that? Right? Now, here's my point. Nobody questions what a day means anywhere else in the Bible. Because in context, we can tell what a day is, all right? The only place people question it is in the first 6 days. Right. And why is that? Is there anything in the Bible that gives us a clue it was millions of years? In fact, if anybody can show me some scripture that says it was millions of years, that would be awesome. Okay, but you can't. All right. The only reason is because, somebody tell me why. Well, evolution, but specifically they're taking something from outside of the Bible and putting it in. Your pastor speaks in what's called exegesis. And eisegesis is when you take something from outside the Bible and force it in. And that is against all hermeneutical principles. We can't be doing that. So, does that make sense? That's the way I would answer it. But you can also get the answers book and go to chapter 2, all right? And you can read all about that. There's also another book out there, 15 Reasons to Take Genesis as History, that will go into great detail about that. Another question. Yes, sir.
How much soft tissue now has been found in fossilized dinosaur bones?
Actually, every time that they've broken open a fossilized dinosaur tissue, after they remove the bony matrix, every time they find soft fossilized soft tissue, it's not fossilized. Because they take away the bone. It's happened, I believe, 100% of the time. So it's happened many, many times. Now the creationists have kind of taken over what the secular scientists have discovered, and they keep finding it over and over and over again. And isn't that just awesome? Because I'll tell you, when I'm on an airplane and I'm sharing, I have a really cool evangelistic tool that unfortunately a lot of you guys have. Well, you have it. And I have it. But what I do is when I sit, first off, I pick a middle seat. I fly around the country. I'm flying to South Africa in 2 weeks. And if I pick a middle seat, the reason I do that is because I have two people to talk to. Now, one of them's going to put the international symbol for don't talk to me, right? But the other, at least I have a 50% chance of starting a conversation. And I smile, make them believe I'm nice. And just, so are you doing business or pleasure? And then, but eventually I go, so what do you do for a living? And then they tell me, and I get interested. I'm usually not. But what I do is I, at least, oh, that's interesting. So you do this? Oh, that's fascinating. And now I've put them in a position where they have to say, so what do you do for a living? And they're like, yes. Ever since I started working for this organization, it's awesome because I can say, oh, I work for an organization that has a bunch of scientists. And what we do is we look at the physical evidence in the world today and show how it supports the historical account of the Bible. And I usually get one of two responses, like, really? That's cool. But most of the time it's like, you what? But I've now started a conversation. All right. And so I get to do those kind of things. And that's one of my favorite things to share. So I pull out my laptop and I show them the pictures and I show that tissue stretching like that. I'm telling you, I've now started a conversation that may lead to something else. So, yeah. All right. Yes.
Can you I have a two-part question. Can you explain the difference between microevolution and evolution that's commonly thought of as, you know, evolution?
Macroevolution, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Can you
All right, so
that?
That's question one.
That's
All
question
right.
one.
If you go to our website, which is? All right, and you look under one of our most popular articles underneath, if you push the topics button, try to remember that. There's a button at the top that says topics, and it'll talk about our top 10 most visited articles, and one of them is called Arguments Creationists Should Not Use. All right, and one of them is exactly that. Unfortunately, a lot of creationists, we're not saying it's a terrible mistake, but it is a mistake. They'll go, well, I believe in microevolution, but not macroevolution. Okay, now here's the problem. Is that you're using terms that people will think, well, if change happens over, just a little bit of change happens over a short amount of time, just give me millions of years and that's all that I'm, all I need. So instead of doing that, we prefer to use the word change over time. Because if I say microevolution, if I accept it, then I open the door for macro or the big picture. So we talk about change over time, and what we can do is actually show how basically, natural selection does not increase the information in the genome. And if you guys, I don't know how much time I have, but I could demonstrate that for you in an easy to understand way too. So, and what's your second question?
Using evolution against those that believe in evolution, what animal has least changed in history?
Oh, the least change. Okay, yeah, okay, what he's talking about, I believe, is what we call living fossils, all right? A living fossil is something that is fossilized that looks exactly like what it does today, which actually is the majority of all creatures. A fossilized bat looks like a bat today. A fossilized jellyfish, which is, by the way, a very rare find, looks exactly like a jellyfish. Pretty much every animal that's found in fossilized form, with the exception of some in the Precambrian, which were some really weird creatures that were the earliest ones destroyed in the flood, which went extinct and aren't with us anymore, virtually all creatures have not changed, if that's what you're asking. Yeah. Another question. What are we doing on time here? One or two more. Any others? Yes.
So you've used the behemoth to describe what we understand as dinosaurs now, but what about the Leviathan?
Ah, Leviathan. Is the woman I talked to this morning here? Oh, she didn't make it. Oh, yeah, yeah. What's the name of the creature?
Sarcosuchus.
Okay, is our best try at thinking of a real animal that comes so closely to matching what Leviathan. Sarcosuchus is basically a big crocodile. All right, really big crocodile. And he has the armor plates and different things that would match that description. But he also has, this is a fossil that's been found, he also has a bulbous nose. So kind of like, you know how the hammerhead comes out and he has his thing sticking out? These two bulbous things have little chambers in it. And right now we have an animal that's called the bombardier beetle, which combines two chemicals in these two chambers and it spits out this boiling hot liquid. And perhaps the same thing was true about that creature as well. So that's our best candidate. One thing we can say is it's a weird creature, and it doesn't exist anymore because we have nothing that comes close. But the fossilized remains of that creature probably are it. Maybe one more? Yes, sir?
Yeah, you can answer this question. At the end of my science class, when I would teach earth science and animals, I would always ask the students this, if they could find it. What species could reproduce with another species and create a new species? And I'm sure you have the answer to that.
I guess I don't. I'm not sure I understand the question. Right. However, I would like to say, yeah, so what he basically says is an ape and an alligator, you don't get an apigator. Okay, that is true. There are limits to what can happen. But I would also warn that species is a man-made term, and scientists are very quick to name new species. In fact, sometimes they get paid money for it if they come up with something new. So, for instance, there are many species of mosquitoes, all right? But they're all blood-sucking little insects, okay? There are differences between it, and there's this species, there's so many. But they are so incredibly similar, and almost all of them can interbreed. All right. So has anybody heard of a liger? If you've watched a very popular film, you know, that has some humor in it, you might have heard of a lion and tiger hybrid. Well, the liger is the biggest cat in the world. Okay, it's a real creature. It's not mythical, and it doesn't have whatever kind of skills that they said, okay? But anyhow, the liger is a real creature. In fact, pretty much all cats can interbreed. That's pretty crazy. All dogs can interbreed, okay? So we believe them to be some of those kinds, according to that. In fact, the liger has fertile offspring. And they would consider them to be very, very distant, a lion, tiger, very distant species, but yet they can breed. So, and that is the study of barominology at Dayton University. They're studying which animals can breed and which ones can't. Okay, one last question.
There's an enormous amount of material out there, and I'm wondering if there's like a course that is offered that you can kind of, you know, cover the waterfront to some extent.
Okay, you asked if there's a course. I would say the best thing, we're actually working on something that will be a course that we're having a difficult time finding the resources, meaning people and manpower. We've actually already put together the content back in December, and then we got kind of stalled because we're making a documentary, which, by the way, will be in theaters in October. We are rather certain we'll know that within 1 week, all right, based on our book, Alien Intrusion, and I won't go into details. But if you signed up for our email newsletter, you will find out about that, and we'd encourage you to go and see that film. But anyhow, so we are doing a course. But I would say the best thing that we have right now is to take the Answers book, this beautiful red book with the big question mark. If you want a real good foundational, go on our website, which is? And then you'll find a study guide that goes along with this. So there's 20 chapters in this. You could start a class of 20 weeks and just have the students read one chapter in the book and then go and use the discussion questions. And that would probably be the best thing to do. Another thing I've shared with a number of people is evolution's Achilles heels, which is about debunking evolution. We have a study guide for that, and you can break that down and make an awesome, awesome class because it's got a movie, and everybody loves movies. I just want to share one last thing, if you don't mind, before we finish up. And since you were my volunteer before, I hope you don't mind me using you as an example. I share with you 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But I didn't finish the verse. And there's a really important part of that verse right after that. It says to do it with gentleness and kindness, with respect. Okay, so I'm going to use you as an example. Let's say that this gentleman is sitting on the plane next to me, all right? And he admits that he believes in evolution. I can take two different ways of talking to him. One way I can do is say, oh, you believe in evolution, really? Well, you know what? What about polystrate fossils? Okay, let me tell you about the bent sedimentary layers. Let me tell you the truth about carbon dating. I want to let you know, since I've read the Answers book, I can win this argument. But am I going to win the person? So I'd like to suggest a different way, the way that I try to do. And that is, I come to you, so you believe in evolution. That's really interesting. Because I've actually read a couple books on that, and I'd like to talk to people about it. So if you don't mind, I ask this question, and I find it really interesting to see what people say. And that is, you believe in evolution, but can you tell me specifically which pieces of evidence convinced you that it's a fact? Now, I'm doing an important thing next. I'm going to zip my lip, and I'm going to be quiet, and I'm going to allow him to speak. It's going to do a couple things. One is, he's going to give me the information of what specifically he has believed. And now I can know, because I've read the Answers book, how to address him. But more important than that, I've just shown him respect, that I care about what he has. Because here's the thing, he's not stupid, he's logical. You remember earlier I said that evolutionists are logical? Now, I know a lot of Christians that have a hard time with that statement, but I want to let you know it's true. Based on what they have heard, they are using logic. They're using the information that they've been told all along, and they're coming to a reasonable conclusion because they've never heard the other side. They've never heard both sides. Remember when we were talking about the analogy of a court case? And it's our job to have a defense for our faith and tell the other side. But now what I've done is I've showed him respect, and I've now started a conversation. And my goal is that by the time we land, or the time we're done talking, is that you and I are going to shake hands, and you're going to thank me for a conversation. You're going to feel respected. I'm going to give you some materials that I carry in my backpack, some brochures and some tracts, and I'm going to give it to you about evolution because I carry those things with me. And then I'm even going to hopefully talk to you again about this. Maybe I'm going to talk to you, I'm going to have lunch with you next Wednesday. All right? So do you see the difference? So please remember that always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you. Do you have to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do it with gentleness and respect. So use this information wisely for the kingdom of God. All right? Thanks a lot.